Have your say in ExchangeWise Industry Review APAC, our in-depth view of the hottest issues impacting the region. Comment on one of six topics: walled gardens, gaming, retail media, the service layer, the open web and CTV, and join ExchangeWire in driving the industry forward. Email info@exchangewire.com to get involved.
The MadTech Podcast, news of the week in ad tech and marketing tech, brought to you by ExchangeWire.
Hello and welcome to this week's episode of the MadTech Podcast, our weekly dive into the world of media, marketing and commerce. I'm Hannah Dillon, staff writer at ExchangeWire, and this week I'm joined by two of my fantastic colleagues. My first guest is CEO of ExchangeWire and also the finest Australian export since the Tim Tam. It's Rachel Smith. Hi, Rachel.
Amazing, Hannah. Best intro ever.
How are you, Rachel?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you, Hannah? First podcast. We're excited to have you as the host.
Oh, yes. It's very exciting. I'm a little bit nervous, so if I do trip over my words, I can only apologise. But yes, very exciting.
It's going to be great.
Thank you. I hope so. Thank you. And also joining me this week, not only is she an editor here at ExchangeWire, but she's also the most serenaded employee at the company, a title which I know brings her endless joy. It's Grace Dillon. Hi, Grace.
Hi. That was unexpected.
Do I speak lies, though?
No, you don't. So I can't argue with that.
Definitely the most serenaded employee at ExchangeWire, and also, listeners, in case you're confused about some similarities between the names and the voices, these two are twin sisters. So spare a thought for me on the Zoom call here with the two faces that look very similar to one another.
Oh yes, doesn't help that we're wearing matching outfits as always.
Yeah, matching outfits, matching haircuts. I just, you know, we don't make it easy for you. Okay, well, I am going to kick off with our first story of the week, which is that a report from the IAB Australia and Pure Profile has found that offering smooth omnichannel shopping experiences that provide convenience and value for money poses the most significant opportunity for brands. The Australian E-commerce Report 2022 also advised retailers to assess their marketing strategies more regularly from 2023 to attract more consumers and to help navigate expected economic uncertainty. The survey of 1,000 Australian shoppers found that despite more consumers returning to shopping in person, the number of people making purchases online has risen to 83% since last year. Some respondents revealed that cost of living concerns are key to their preference for online, where it's easier to find price comparisons on products. Meanwhile, 58% say that they regularly read retailer content, such as emails and their websites, and 90% are signed up to at least one loyalty scheme. However, on the flip side, 55% report some concern about how retailers use their data, and 24% say that they don't know whether retailers share their data with third parties. So, Rachel, as you are Australian, I will come to you first.
And I was just going to say, and obviously one of Australia's finest exports. Thank
well,
you very
absolutely.
Much.
There was a method and a meaning behind the intro.
I've never been likened to a Tim Tam. I'm delighted, I have to say. Thank you very much, Hannah, for that intro. I thought this was a really interesting news release for a couple of reasons. The first is that big shout out to the IAB Australia, who quite frankly produced some fantastic research reports with some regularity. I know that's very much you know, behind the fact that the great team that Gay Leroy, the IAB CEO there, has got in place, and they're really quite committed to producing some really good quality stats, data and information on which the industry can you know, base not just their perception of what's happening in the marketplace, but how they might be tackling some of the biggest challenges facing advertising and marketing. So it's a really good example of what IABs can be doing for their members and also for the industry in a wider context. So I thought it was a really good quality research report. I also thought it was really interesting because we are spending quite a lot of time talking about the opportunity in retail media for various brands. And I thought this e-com report sort of gave us a little bit of insight insight into not just consumer sentiment, but perhaps how retailers are organising themselves in a particular marketplace to take advantage of some of that consumer activity. So even though this report focuses explicitly on Australia, obviously, I thought it was really interesting to look at it in comparison to other marketplaces, retail marketplaces, and a couple of things stood out. The convenience and value for money sort of insight is not surprising, but a bit of background to the Australian e-commerce industry or marketplace is that prior to the pandemic, e-com shopping was probably a lot lower in comparison, certainly to here in the UK and perhaps other European markets and to the US as well. And one of the key reasons for that was not so much an issue with popularity of online shopping, but more to do with infrastructure and convenience. So obviously the pandemic has not just sort of boosted the e-commerce industry in Australia like it has pretty much everywhere else in the world. I think it's probably also boosted the sophistication of some of the fundamental aspects of the industry, which is infrastructure and, you know, how you make this a convenient alternative for shoppers to doing something in person. So that's why I found this report really interesting, because I think it's picking up on that. You know, consumers are doing more online shopping in Australia, not just because they've sort of, you know, it's been growing in popularity slowly in the background anyway, but because the convenience of it has improved. And definitely that's what I noticed when I go back to Australia and I speak with friends and family. You know, a couple of years ago, they were all talking about, oh God, I can't believe you do almost all of your grocery shopping online and a lot of your clothes shopping and fashion item shopping online. That just to them was not that common. And now it's become really commonplace. So I think that sort of transition's interesting. Then the other thing I thought was really interesting was just trying to sort of reflect on what impact that might be having for brands on the retail media side of the industry. And I think you're seeing some interesting things coming out of Australia, which are also being, you know, and perhaps have been borrowed from, who knows? I don't know, you know, I don't know where the push came first, but there's some similarities growing in the US as well. So you've got a big Australian supermarket retailer, Woolworths, have got a really sophisticated e-com and retail media offering called Woolies X. Actually, that bundles up everything. It bundles up their, you know, loyalty program, their e-commerce infrastructure, so delivery and I suppose, you know, for want of a better way to describe it, click and collect. I think they call it something like deliver to boot. So you can order your groceries online, drive up to the supermarket, and then somebody drops it off in your car for you. So Woolies X kind of bundles all of those opportunities, but it looks like a really sophisticated retail media offering for brands, for other brands to be getting involved in to try to hit their consumers in the right places, either in store or online. And that looks really similar to what Walmart's doing in the US. So I just thought this was a really interesting report because it's reflecting some of that. And I'm just wondering how much those trends might start to become more obvious in other e-com and retail marketplaces as well.
Yeah, absolutely. That was, yeah, I think at least from reading the report, I thought that it was the findings weren't necessarily surprising, I think, especially thanks to the COVID pandemic. But definitely interesting, I think, to see the extent of growth. Grace, what do you think? Do you think that, do you agree with the idea that this is a trend that we're seeing outside of the Australian market? What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, from the research that I've done, you know, it's certainly not exclusive to Australia. People are generally shopping more online for, you know, groceries, household items, etc., even as we are coming out of the kind of core pandemic age, if that's what we would call it, when, you know, we had to stay at home and, you know, in-person shopping was incredibly limited. I think we have, as we've noted numerous times, we've obviously come to an age where convenience and to an extent, maybe instant gratification, or maybe not instant, but, you know, quick time gratification is certainly more of an expectation. And I think that has influenced people's shopping habits and obviously as well their expectations of what retailers can offer them. And so brands are having to, you know, adjust their strategies to try and meet those expectations. Thinking about the retail media aspect, you know, in the UK this week we had news of, you know, Tesco launching with Dunnhumby and JCDecaux. They've launched the Smart Screen Network, so they've opened up 63%, I think, of their large format screens to advertisers, with the promise of allowing them to target customers who visit based on, you know, in-store data. And, you know, they claim that that's going to enable advertisers to reach about 6 million shoppers, you know, every fortnight. It's a huge number of people. So we're obviously seeing, a huge retailer that has already, you know, made moves in the retail media space with, you know, the launch of their insights platform with Dunnambee, are, you know, really persevering and trying to really, you know, expand that space and make them as accessible to advertising partners as possible. I think an interesting note for me, thinking about this a bit more broadly, is, you know, how brands are going to adjust to the kind of greater emphasis on convenience. And, you know, I read one report where it may have been in Asia exclusively, I can't quite remember, but, you know, a high proportion of shoppers expect delivery within 2 hours. And I'm sure that's not, you know, that doesn't apply to every single order they make, but, you know, that's a staggering turnaround that, you know, I don't know if even Amazon, who are the biggest, you know, online marketplace, can achieve that with every single order, you know. So I think an important note is how retailers are going to be able to manage these expectations and also meet consumers where they are. As we've mentioned, you know, there's a big cost of living crisis, and, you know, retailers certainly wouldn't want to be seen as trying to capitalize off of people's, you know, need to budget. You know, but there is an opportunity there for them to strategize in a way that will serve their customers and, you know, provide a real value exchange while also, you know, enabling them to open up to other advertisers and, you know, make a business out of that. So yeah, bit of a scattered response.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's a wealth of information in there, so it's, you know, there's quite a lot to get through. I think there was just because you mentioned about the cost of living crisis, Grace, and one of the stats that was pulled from the report is that 90% of respondents to the IAB and Pure Profiles report, or I should say 90% of the respondents said they were signed up to at least one loyalty scheme. And as you mentioned, there's a cost of living crisis, so I think you know, consumers are trying to save money as and when they can. And are looking for brands that they can trust, and there's a greater emphasis on loyalty. Do you both, Grace and Rachel, do you think that this will impact retailers or brands and their strategy? Do you think that they have to work harder to maintain loyalty from their consumers, from their customers?
I mean, it's an interesting question, Hannah, because I sort of think in the world of online shopping, the concept of building brand loyalty can go very much hand in hand with the convenience thing, right? So, you know, again, that's why it's not surprising to see that people, when they're shopping online, are looking for convenience and value for money, because it might be value for money that takes them to a particular retailer or to a particular product off the back of some research or what have you, or even just basic Google search. But then the loyalty, I think, comes from the entire experience. So, and convenience is an intrinsic part of that in an online shopping environment. So, for example, you know, I do the majority of my grocery shopping with Ocado because I've used them for years and because the convenience is top notch. Is it always the best value for money? I believe it's pretty good value for money because they certainly do a lot of price comparisons and there's some, you know, options there. But I know that I probably could save money by walking up to the high street and going to maybe some of the more local shops, which I do even post-pandemic. I do that as well, not always from a budgeting point of view, but also just from a preference point of view and maybe sometimes wanting to support local grocery stores, etc. But my loyalty to Ocado has definitely been built up via the convenience route. So I think that for brands and retailers looking to achieve that and looking to sort of, I suppose, respond to the idea that shoppers want convenience and value for money, I think they've got to be well organized to make sure that they're, you know, that they can actually get some opportunity out of that. So they've got to be price competitive, but they have to have their delivery infrastructure and even just their customer service really lined up nicely. And as Grace mentioned, that will depend enormously on what market we're talking about, right? Like, I mean, 2-hour delivery window in London would just be the best thing ever. But is that ever going to be realistic? And, you know, in some instances, maybe a short delivery window is more likely in a large city like London, because you might be closer to your point of, you know, wherever the products are being derived from. But then on the other hand, traffic and all sorts of other things are going to prevent that from being possible. Whereas, you know, the example that you gave, Grace, I'm not sure whether it was in Asia or not, but if it was, that makes total sense, right? Because there's a lot of delivery infrastructure that's provided on motorbikes and bicycles, and it's a completely different environment where it might be possible to get deliveries in a really short window of time. Anyway, long-winded way of saying brand building, I think, in an online environment is intrinsically linked to convenience.
Yeah, absolutely. Grace, what do you think?
I think there's maybe an exception to that in, at least in the UK and maybe other parts of Europe, in terms of like Lidl and Aldi, which are, but their value proposition is that they have always been cheaper than the mainstream supermarkets. So, you know, they don't have the delivery infrastructure, but, you know, the lack of the delivery option is made up for in the fact that, you know, you are saving comparatively a lot more. That said, obviously, I haven't done a direct price-to-price comparison, but just from listening to my dad, who does shop at Aldi and Lidl, their prices have gone up anyway because of, you know, the cost of living and inflation, etc. Whether that's, you know, to such an extent that Tesco is now, or Sainsbury's or whoever, has now become, you know, there's less of a margin of difference, I'm not sure. But I do think that, you know, when we think about the cost of shopping, it is also the cost of time as well as, you know, expense if people are working and, you know, even from home, and in a situation where they may need to take on more hours. You know, you don't know people's personal circumstances and they actually have the time to shop, then yeah, it's going to make up for spending perhaps slightly more money. Yeah, so I think in terms of the loyalty element, I think it really is going to be, we talk a lot about value exchanges, and I think a lot of the time we talk about how advertisers aren't great at sharing or expressing the value exchange of advertising. I think while there's probably a more obvious one, to say the least, with a supermarket or shopping, I think just really showing the, making sure that there is a real value exchange and that the schemes actually offer, you know, a tangible benefit is going to be imperative to, you know, ensuring loyalty from consumers.
And you know what's interesting about that as well, Grace, I agree with you completely, is that even if we think about the in-store shopping experience at the likes of Aldi and Lidl these days, they are becoming more convenient, you know, self-service tills, you know, and I could see more technology being used in that environment. For example, potentially maybe an app with a scanner. I don't know, you know, whether they would consider doing that, but you never know, because they must be pushing more customers through their doors as a result of having a faster point of sale process. And so when I go to those stores, because I love them both too, and in fact, you know, I love them for their prices, but also sometimes it is a brand thing that I'm going for. It is actually something that I know only Aldi does or only Lidl does. And the improvement in convenience is taking me there more often. So I do think that even though we've come from an environment where traditionally where, you know, cheaper prices meant that we would be willing to endure less convenience, I think we're all slowly being sort of marched towards this convenience is not just about cheap pricing. It's also about time that I might have to spend doing other things. So, you know, I think all retailers need to be mindful of that.
Yeah. Wonderful. So we're going to stay on the topic of shopping, but we are going to move on to our second story of the week, which is that Facebook is set to close its live shopping feature as it turns its attention towards video. From 1st of October this year, users will no longer be able to host any live shopping events on the platform, nor to tag items or create product playlists, although Facebook Live will still be available to broadcast in real time. In a blog post, Facebook parent Meta confirmed that the company would instead prioritise Reels, its short-form video feature for Facebook and Instagram. The company also directly encouraged readers to try experimenting with Reels in order to reach and engage people through video. The move reaffirms Meta's desire to get in on the rampant success of TikTok, who also recently stepped away from live shopping. In July, the video sharing platform shelved plans to take TikTok Shop to the US and Europe, with commentators noting that live shopping's popularity seems to be confined to Asia. So again, I'm going to start with you, Rachel, on this and just pose the question. Do you agree with commentators that social or live commerce seems to be an opportunity that's exclusive to Asia?
It's a very good question, one that we will be attempting to tackle in some detail when we're over in Singapore, ATS Singapore in September. But it is a really interesting question because I've had discussion with a number of people in APAC about live commerce. It tends to be called a lot, social commerce, live shopping, and how it's unfolding in the APAC market, whether that's in Southeast Asia or whether that's in North Asia, and then what the subsequent opportunity might be in international markets. And I think the distinguishing feature, apart from there's lots of avenues we could go down when discussing this, you know, is it cultural differences? Is it marketplace differences? I think one of the distinctive features is that when I think in certainly me and perhaps others in Western economies think about things like live shopping, my mind immediately goes to infomercials and, you know, info channels that, you know, of the kind of 80s and 90s that just don't seem terribly appealing or as though they would really reach the markets that they're attempting to reach. And I know that's not what it is. And I'm quite sure that, I mean, obviously I personally was very disappointed that Facebook won't be offering live shopping anymore because, oh my God, I used to spend so much time indulging in live shopping channels. So I know that it's not going to be like that. I know that it would be completely different, but I wonder if we're just so wedded to this idea of being sold to in a video environment that we can't think of it as any other way. Now, what I'm told by experts who know so much more about this than I do is that in Asia, particularly in North Asia, these live shopping experiences aren't done by celebrities and influencers. They're actually, the videos are hosted by product experts. And so they're either product experts that work within the brand, or they're a bit like, product experts that you would expect to find in an in-person retail store, someone that actually, you know, understands the makeup counter, someone that actually, you know, was an expert in the various, you know, makeup products that they might be looking to sell. And so that immediately takes on a completely different format. And that makes me think that I don't see why live shopping and live commerce wouldn't then become popular in Western economies and Western environments, because I know that when you think about what children are doing in a video context, unboxing, watching videos of people putting together various products and you know, games and so forth, and then seeing how they actually get used and how they enjoy those, I don't see how it wouldn't actually become popular here. I think at the moment it's just a mismatch between what it's actually been presented to us as and how people are using it. Now, of course, these things get driven by where brands are making money, and so it just doesn't seem like that's a particularly lucrative channel at the moment. But what I know from chatting with, like I said, various colleagues and experts over in APAC in particular, I'm going to have to name check him because I know he's a real Mad Tech podcast fan, Fionn Hindman, who I've been chatting to quite a lot recently, and he was telling me that the live shopping, live commerce marketplace in China is just enormous, and it's difficult to imagine that it won't somehow translate to international economies at some stage.
Grace, what are your thoughts on this? Do you agree that with a little bit of tweaking, live shopping or live commerce could actually be quite successful in the UK and Europe and beyond?
I mean, doing research ahead of this, I, you know, did come across a couple of brands who have experimented with live shopping in the UK. So it was like Snug Sofa, Ted Baker, and M&S.
Spencer.
That's the one. Yeah. So, you know, there seems to be an interest from, you know, bigger brands to experiment with it. So perhaps it's a shame, really, that Facebook has shuttered this, and you know, we heard as well earlier that TikTok have dropped their plans to bring their live shopping feature to the UK as well. So maybe they are being a bit, maybe being a bit rash. I obviously don't know the ins and outs of Meta's or TikTok's strategies and budgets, etc. But maybe it's a shame. Maybe it could have developed into something bigger. I think it's interesting the point you made, Rachel, about how where, you know, in China, where live shopping is more popular, and like I've understood, it accounts for 10% of the Chinese e-commerce market. So it's obviously, you know, a significant element of shopping. But I think it's interesting that, you know, they have the product experts instead of influencers, and the kind of how that would translate culturally in the UK, because I think, you know, from where we are, you know, my one point of reference is Marks and Spencer's, admittedly, television adverts, where they do seem to have product experts. And for me personally, I don't find them particularly endearing. but at the same time, I don't think I would find seeing a celebrity, you know, promoting it any more convincing or any more attractive. I think for the UK, and maybe even more so in the US, you know, influencer marketing is a very different beast, in that the influencer has kind of already established themselves with an audience, has already won over an audience, and in a way has more of a niche, and is sort of better positioned to advertise to a more niche audience that already respects them or follows them to varying degrees. We've seen, you know, incidents where they've had brand deals that have fallen through because of their own behavior and their own unsavory goings on and doings, or they've promoted items that aren't particularly good quality, and then they lose the trust of their audience. So I think it's just a very different setup over here in terms of who or what kinds of people consumers, and particularly younger consumers, would pay attention to or feel in any way kind of endeared to and want to hear about a product from. But I do definitely agree with the kind of cultural difference in terms of how we view live shopping, because to me it does just, I just think of QVC, even though it's a completely different environment. And, you know, think back to, you know, when I mean, we used to watch QVC occasionally at university when there was nothing else on.
Entertainment.
Yeah, with, you know, with no intention of buying anything. No, so, you know,
pure entertainment.
Yeah, and, you know, you, like, again, it's the same. I think I would assume in the US, looking at, you know, the Simpsons and their juice loosener, where you get a drop of orange juice out of a whole bag of oranges, because the only other way to get orange juice out of an orange is pressing it against your head. You know, you have
these.
You
mean there's a better way?
Apparently so. The juice loosener. I can't believe they invented it. You know, you just have these images of a very outdated sort of format where people who you either don't really know or don't really have any sort of affiliation with are just pitching you a kind of half-baked, not particularly high quality product. And I think maybe that's the lingering sort of idea that just means we're not quite ready to embrace, you know, live shopping as it actually is.
Yeah. I mean, there's so many reasons why, you know, modern live shopping experiences would be nothing like that, not least of all consumer control, right? We'd be talking about a platform where you can fast forward through a video, where you can, I'm just thinking of the QVC days where it would just go on and on and on and on, which is what made it so enjoyable to watch as a student. But like, it's just, no one's going to suffer through that, right? And no one's got the attention. I mean, no one ever had the attention for that. But obviously the model back then was, you know, the volume of messaging and the repetitive nature of the messaging, hoping to catch enough people at certain times in the day. This is an entirely different world where you could imagine really short, succinct videos that just show you what the product is, how you use it, and what it works on, could be really useful. And I reckon that done in the right way, it would actually take off massively. I can think of so many things that I've purchased online recently, household items, whether they're to do with something DIY around the house or something in the garden, that it just would have been great to be able to click on the product and see a video then and there, not have to then Google it, then have a look at a YouTube video, then scroll through, try and find the video that's actually showing me the thing I need to look at. You know, there's such an opportunity to bring all that together. And I can't believe that brands don't see that. I'm sure that they do. And I can't believe that various social media platforms or other video platforms don't have the sophisticated capability to make that work as an omni-channel marketing experience that consumers actually enjoy. It's definitely got to be out there somewhere.
Yeah, absolutely. I hate to cut this conversation short because I think there's so much that we could go into. There's so much more to discuss, but I will take us on to our third and final story of the week, which is that AppLovin sought to buy Unity in a deal that would have excluded ironSource. However, Unity has turned AppLovin down. Shock horror. So earlier this month, app marketing software provider AppLovin offered to buy video game software company Unity in an all-stock merger for $17.5 billion. The deal would have excluded ironSource, a software provider specializing in app distribution and monetization, which Unity publicly announced its intention to buy for $4.4 billion back in July. A successful merger between AppLovin and Unity would have bolstered AppLovin's supplies of first-party data, which would enhance AppLovin's machine learning algorithms. A deal would have also expanded its tech stack to include analytics, attribution, 3D game creation, monetization, programmatic advertising, and user acquisition tools. So basically everything but the kitchen sink. AppLovin predicted that the combined entity would have created a run rate of over $3 billion by 2024. However, Unity rejected the offer on the 15th of August, with the company announcing its intent to pursue the ironSource deal as originally planned. So, Rachel, again, I'm going to come to you first on this. Why do you think AppLovin made this offer, and why do you think Unity's turned them down?
I mean, this was sort of like the comedy ad tech acquisition shenanigans story of the week, right? Because when we first talked about including it in the podcast, you know, Unity had yet to reject AppLovin's offer. So we found that even more amusing, right? That AppLovin were saying, yeah, we're going to buy you, but not with ironSource. So they've got the kind of right to say that. I think from Unity's point of view, although the AppLovin offer could potentially have been interesting to them, I think that because they were, you know, prepared to pay a sizable amount of money, I think that ultimately Unity are going to get more out of ironSource in the long run. And I think the clincher here is that ironSource, from what I understand from doing just an additional bit of research, is a profitable company, right? And AppLovin might have big revenues, but it's nowhere near as profitable. So I think Unity at this stage, probably already having done a degree of due diligence on their potential purchase of ironSource, feel confident about what they're going to be getting from that business. And I'd like to hope, I don't know if it's true, but I'd like to hope this is an example of where it's not always just about the money that can be thrown around. It's also about the quality of, you know, leadership and work being undertaken in a company. And if it is the case that ironSource are a very profitable company, that comes with, you know, that doesn't just drop out of the sky. It's not just as a result of potentially having good products and a lot of customers. It's as a result of really hard work and keeping your eye firmly focused on the bottom line. And so, yeah, it'd be nice if this is actually a story of, well, we're going to go for the company that we think is slightly better run and more profitable and a better long-term bet.
Yeah, absolutely. Grace, what do you think?
So from my often cited research, the research I did before this podcast, it does certainly seem as though AppLovin would need Unity more than Unity would need AppLovin. And, you know, from what I've read, it just seems like a more promising proposition. From my understanding, a Unity AppLovin merger would kind of just, you know, build on what Unity already does with a few, like, added, you know, I mean, AppLovin are changing their strategy to focus a bit more on software, so it kind of bolster their you know, software division and development of games. But it seems like ironSource offers something, you know, further beyond that, which would actually benefit Unity more and help them to actually expand. Unity and ironSource both saw their stock fall this year. Unity was down around 75%, and I mean, ironSource were also down around 50%, so, you know, significant chunks. So it seems like a deal that could benefit both of them. So it just seems like it, you know, I agree with Rachel that hopefully it is just, you know, made from business sense rather than from kind of profit. And also, you know, rather than to skirt or avoid having to pay a breakup fee, which you would imagine would be very substantial considering it's a the Unity Iron Source merger is $4.4 billion.
And also, I mean, AppLovin were offering what, an all stock deal. I'm not sure how seductive that is at the moment, really. So, you know, I don't blame, like we've just both said, you know, I hope this is being made with a good, strong business mind at the forefront of it. But if Unity had already done, you know, their background research and decided that Iron Source was a really good asset for them, you would hope that they wouldn't just be sidetracked by a stock offering merger, and it looks like they're not.
Yeah, absolutely. And what a question really for both of you, what do you think is going to happen next? Do you think anything's going to happen next? Do you think AppLovin's going to take any drastic action to try and continue wooing Unity, or do you think they're going to get the message and walk away with the tail between their legs?
It's a good question, isn't it? Because why did they put the offer forward in the first instance? Like I said, the piece of research that I did suggested that AppLovin's revenue position is quite strong. You know, they've got really high revenue at the moment. So will they go back to the drawing board and think, could we make a more enticing offer and something that isn't just all stock? And do they think that will make a difference? But they'll have to know that, you know, as Grace mentioned, if Unity were to about face on their Iron Source acquisition plans, there'd be some kind of penalty at this stage. And so they'd have to be prepared to compensate for that. So is AppLovin in a financial position where they can improve their offer, or have they just made themselves look a little bit like the, you know, entertaining conversational topic of the week in the world of ad tech M&A.
Yeah, I guess we'll have to wait and see, really. Grace, do you have any more thoughts on that?
Well, there was a hypothesis floated that AppLovin may be trying to deflect from the fact that they've cut their revenue expectation or their revenue guidance for their apps business, which, again, something may preempt them doing the same for the software side of their business. I don't know how true that is, whether it's accurate or whether it's just a consideration. But if it is, if there is some truth to it, it might be the case that they just think, well, we've maybe embarrassed ourselves a bit here. We shouldn't do that any further. And maybe look at acquiring another company or merging with a different company instead, or just focusing on, you know, whatever pain points have caused them to cut their expectations. But I think going back to, sorry, to backtrack to my last sort of the response to the last question, where I kind of said that, you know, Iron Source is a better proposition. From my understanding, merging with Iron Source will give Unity more user data and also help developers, you know, to monetize their games earlier. And that does feed into kind of a wider debate about the value of video games as an art form. And I think, I mean, Unity, the CEO of Unity, got into quite a lot of hot water after announcing the Iron Source merger because of some comments he made about game developers and creatives, and described them with a rather expletive word in a sort of backhanded backhanded compliment, which caused a lot of furore. You know, so it may be the case as well that, you know, whatever offer AppLovin comes up with, you know, A, it's not really as valuable as merging with Iron Source, where they will get that more of that user data. They can create more enticing games based off of that. And also, you know, stemming the damage, the kind of reputational damage that was spurred from John Riccitiello kind of saying that, you know, creatives aren't savvy and aren't interested in monetizing their property, and I guess kind of throw away any of the sort of PR salvaging attempt they've made to get on the good side of Iron Source, but also of game developers and gaming fans. So personally, I don't think whether AppLovin come back with a new offer, I doubt Unity's going to accept it. I'd be amazed personally.
It sort of feels a little bit like a soap opera. So, I mean, I'm, you know, kind of enthusiastically awaiting any news of what happens next.
Well, I was going to say, now that Neighbours is over, we need to
find something else.
Need some other source of entertainment, really.
brilliant.
So that brings us to the end of this week's podcast. Rachel, Grace, thank you very much for joining me this week. It was delightful. I think a lot of really great discussions there. So thanks very much for your time. And thank you for listening as well. We'll be back with a new episode of the MadTech podcast this time next week. But in the meantime, you can find the latest news and developments in AdTech on our website and in The Stack, our weekly roundup of hot topics in the industry. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next time.